I think there's nothing scarier in human medicine and animal medicine for that matter than the idea of going back to a pre-antibiotic world.
Today, I had the privilege of sitting down with Dr. Kristen Pagriba-Brown from the Mellon Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health. Dr. Pagriba-Brown is an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Mellon Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona. She's the creator and director of the Student Aid for Field Epidemiology Response Team and is the head of the One Health track at the College of Public Health. I'm also here with Rachel Lay. Rachel got her MPH in Global Health from the University of Arizona and has been involved in a range of initiatives, including promoting parental monitoring of infant growth to prevent childhood obesity and improving city government planning processes to better foster equity and inclusion. She currently works at the University of Arizona in the Norton School of Family and Consumer Sciences doing community-based research and evaluation. Thanks for joining me. Can you discuss SAFER and how you came up with the idea? If I remember correctly, it came out of your dissertation work?
So it was actually before my dissertation. So when I was doing my master's here, my MPH, I was talking to Dr. Robin Harris, who has been in our epidemiology department for a very long time. And she was my advisor at the time, and she mentioned wanting to have she thought it'd be very cool if we could create a student outbreak response team. And then she basically announced to everyone that I was doing it. So so as part of my master's, I did a needs assessment of the health departments to kind of find out what, if they had students come work with the health department, what kind of information they would want them to have ahead of time, what kind of training they would want them to have, what kinds of activities they could do. So, you know, we've gotten to the point now where SAFER students can really act essentially like a CDI, which is a communicable disease investigator. And so we are able to do the routine surveillance calls. We do a lot of those for all the different enteric infections, but we also do and have done in the past a lot of outbreak investigations. So that can be, we've done outbreaks anything from a lot of foodborne outbreaks. So you'll have, you know, your typical wedding type of outbreak. And we'll talk to the people who are attending and work with the health departments. They'll get us the line lists and we do a lot of the interviews. We've also done flu outbreaks and, you know, measles and other kinds of things. The big measles outbreak that happened a couple of years ago, we worked with Maricopa County Department of Public Health to contact patients who'd been at a particular hospital. So there's all kinds of different ways that SAFER has been involved and works really hand in hand with a lot of the health departments. We work primarily with Maricopa County, but we're available to work for or work with all of the different health departments across Arizona. And we have worked with Pima and Coconino and other health departments. And so the idea was that we wanted to have students who were trained to do outbreaks, but the problem is you can't predict when an outbreak is going to happen. I mean, that's, you know, obviously that's kind of the nature of outbreaks, right? And so we came up with a format for the class so that students would get training on doing some of the routine surveillance, one, so that they actually get those skills. And you know, when we've, as I tell students, it doesn't matter if you want to go in infectious diseases or cancer or, HIV, even genomics, in order to be a good epidemiologist, you have to be able to talk to people and you have to be able to garner information. And like you said, we have to be able to somehow translate the information that we talk to people into data.
Into actions.
And so one of the things that we wanted is that students would get that experience doing those interviews even when an outbreak isn't happening. And so that's why we started doing the routine surveillance. And so the format of the class is students take the class where they learn all the skill sets associated with doing an outbreak investigation. But then they also, as Sana mentioned, working in the call. So we have a call center, which is essentially a lab or an office space that we've converted, and it has telephones and computers and all these things. And so we get the list of the cases from Maricopa County. So for instance, we do all the Campylobacter cases and we interview them. And so it gives students the opportunity to practice those interview skills. And as you mentioned, they're very detailed oftentimes. Yeah. And but if you can't have a conversation with somebody in public health, then then you probably need to be an analyst, right? And so you're not
knowing where you fit,
right? And so it's a matter. In fact, I've had great analysts who think that they can't do interviews do good interviews, and so a lot of times it's just a matter of getting over that hump of feeling like you can't do it, or more kind of getting over the nervousness. And then once you get to the point, once you've done interviews several times, then it gets to the point where it's like, okay, I can do this, and I can talk to people and get this information. And then the next step of it is showing students how, you know, you can have a stack of paper interviews that you've completed, and it could have that smoking gun associated with the outbreak, or you could have, you know, really important risk factors. But until you translate that information into data that can be analyzed, it doesn't matter if the smoking gun's sitting in there or not. You're never going to know it. And so figuring out a way of showing people how to translate that information so that you see, like you said, where that data comes from, I think gives people much better appreciation of, one, the importance of doing a good interview, because if you do a crappy interview, you get crappy data. And two, also then how that data then go forward to make policy decisions and other kinds of things. And so it really shows along that continuum of how it's, you know, it starts with an interview, and then it goes to like data entry and data cleaning, and then, which data cleaning is an art in and of itself, and then the analysis, and then the policies that come after that. And so I think it's important for people to see that kind of continuum. We have a very kind of standardized way of doing that, which also is also gets back to kind of quality data collection. So we want to make sure that the data we collect is different, or is that the highest quality possible. And we've actually seen a lot of the variables, you know, we've had much less missing data once we started doing those in certain variables than they've had in the past. And part of it's just because we'd really drill in with students. It's really important to get this information. And, you know, it's funny, I was thinking about, because there are some programs around campus that will have students do rotations in labs and other kinds of things. And we just never do any of that, because while, you know, if I was in a wet lab, we could set up an experiment and you could use, you know, you could even split a sample and you could have somebody do an experiment with something. And if they totally ruin it, it's not that big of a deal, right? Yeah, you might have part of some cells get destroyed or some bacteria, but you have backups, you have other things. And, you know, we can't do that with our lab, because everything is real. Like, the data is all, you're talking to real people, you're collecting real data, and there's no do-overs. So if you have a really horrible interview with somebody and you have somebody who does a really bad job, you don't get to call that person back and say, hey, can we try again? And you could try, but I can guarantee you they're not going to say yes. And so because of that, we really make sure that our students are well-trained and that the TAs really know what to look for when they listen to the interviews. And so I think that's also something that we really make sure that we're kind of taking into account, is how serious it is that you're collecting real data.
Well, one of the questions that Rachel asked me yesterday when I was talking to her about my experience was, so how many people want to, like, take your call, and how many people want to talk to you?
And how do you get them to answer all of the questions? Because it's a lot of questions about everything they've eaten.
It is.
It's very detailed. So I told her, which it's my honest answer, and please chime in with your opinion, the people that want to take the survey are the ones that say, I want to find out what happened because I don't want this to happen to anybody else. And so you can really see, like you mentioned, like the real world implications of what you're doing and how important it is to real people, because they are sick. And a lot of the calls that we have are people that are in the hospital or have just gotten out of the hospital, or they've seen their kids get sick. So if we are interviewing, if it's a minor that has had the illness that we're talking about, we usually talk to the parents, and that's great because the parents always know everything that's been going on. So that's great. But you can really see the actual applications.
I mean, I think because of the way the surveillance system works is you're only talking to people who get the most sick, right? Because we only talk to people who get sick enough to go to the doctor, get a sample taken, have that sample tested. And so if you have a mild stomach ache, you're not going to go to the doctor. And so because of the nature of how the surveillance works, you have people who are really, really sick. And And like Sana said, they want to figure out, one, what happened to them for their own interests, and two, make sure that it doesn't happen to somebody else if there's a way to avoid it. And so I think, you know, and again, health departments have been doing this for a really long time, and so they also, you know, we do trainings with Maricopa Health Department, Maricopa County, and also the State Health Department on how to do, like, best practices with interviewing. There's also some great resources out there, like Colorado has really great resources on doing interviewing. And some of it is just, part of it is like anything else, it's just appealing to people on a personal level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, showing people that you have empathy for what they have gone through. I mean, everybody's been sick at some point.
What are some of the outbreaks that SAFER has been involved in investigating? So I'm not too familiar when the Chipotle situation happened,
so,
or is it more local?
Yeah,
or?
So we've done a lot of different ones. So the Chipotle one, so it kind of depends on how the outbreak unfolds.
Okay.
So there are kind of, there's two types, really, of outbreaks. One is where you have somebody who, it's kind of a community-wide outbreak. So mm-hmm. the Chipotle outbreak, the Costco berries, the other kinds of things. And so sometimes you can get a list of people who, so like for Costco, for instance, like the State Health Department, I'm sure, is working with them to see who bought all those items. Mm-hmm. And it's great because they have those cards that they, so they can link that information. You can get those robocalls and, mm-hmm. and other things. But a lot of times, you know, you don't have that at Chipotle, right? Somebody can go up and pay cash. You have no idea who they are.
I would just like to point out that I ate at Chipotle today.
Oh.
Add that to my list of places I ate in the last.
And so you really have to think about it.
I was like,
so
I like
hard.
Chipotle. So it's you know, I mean, I think in some ways, actually eating at a place after they've had an outbreak is probably the safest time to eat there, right? Because they're more concerned about their food safety, right? But we've also had outbreaks where, and these are the ones that SAFER has been involved with most recently, is we'll call somebody and, like a salmonella case, for instance, and we'll say, do you know anyone else who is sick? And they'll go, oh, yeah. Yeah, I know like 10 other people who are sick. And then so we will let the health department know that, and then we'll start to follow up on those cases to find out, you know, what common meal they might have had or mm-hmm. other kinds of things. So sometimes it happens like that, where we will just kind of discover an outbreak. And so then we can talk to the health department, and then they'll work with environmental services if need be. So maybe if it was a catered event or they all went to a certain place. So that's one type. Another was an example where we were doing interviews, and Erica, who's the lab manager, was doing an interview. And so she was talking to somebody about a exposure they had at a restaurant, and it was kind of a weird name of a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so she had done an interview, and then she was entering the data from somebody else's interview, and they had mentioned the same restaurant. Mm-hmm. And again, it's one of those where it's a very strange, you know, there's one location in like the whole state. It's not like McDonald's where there's, you know, thousands of locations, right? So, and so she, you know, put that in our emails, like, FYI, there's something weird maybe going on here. We should probably look into it. And so then the health department could look at the PFGE patterns of those, and it turns out it was. And then we started finding more and more and more cases. So the difference with that outbreak is you don't always know what you're working with at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. So it could have an outbreak of 4 cases, or you could have an outbreak of 400 cases. And sometimes, you know, a big portion of what epidemiologists do is find those cases and then try to actually put the pieces together, because somebody, it turns out, you know, like, for instance, norovirus is really common. And so mm-hmm. you might call somebody and they go, oh, yeah, I knew 6 people who are sick. You call 5 of those people and they all have similar symptoms. And then you call that 6th person and they were like, oh, yeah. And they describe their symptoms and it doesn't really have anything to do or sound similar at all to anything else. And maybe they just happen to have norovirus at the same time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
part of that is like figuring out who belongs in your case definition and who doesn't, and how mm-hmm. they all fit in that
it's
picture.
It's such a puzzle. Yeah. So do you think movies get it right?
And depends on the movie.
Yeah.
You know,
any other recommendation?
So, I mean, I still think Contagion actually is a very well done public health movie. I think it was adequately scary for people, and actually probably maybe even downplayed the scariness of things. But So for movies like that, I mean, it had all of the right elements of, you know, people dying pretty quick. I actually had a high school student ask me that. She was like, don't you think they wouldn't have died that quick? And I was like, well, I'm like, you know, Gwyneth touched the pig and then she flew home. And then I was like, no, that's like 3 to 5 days. That's probably about accurate. So some movies are pretty good. I think like the World War Z movies of the world are just, I think zombie movies in general, I don't like, because I used to do a lot of preparedness work and I feel like they're just depressing to me. Yeah. I mean, even if they're supposed to be funny, they're still based on this whole premise that like 95% of the population is dead or somehow,
what did
you know,
prepare for?
And also,
right, exactly.
Why did the zombies have to run?
Right.
Zombies aren't going to run.
Right. So that's the other, you mean like, the scary, you know, when they run really fast, those are the scary zombies. So
I'm curious how you navigate kind of communicating and working on public health issues with people outside of the public health field. So for example, working with farmers and what that's like kind of bridging across very different professions.
So I think, I work with a lot of other faculty that also have experience in that area. So for instance, like I work with people who are in extension and they do a lot. And in those areas. And I think that the biggest way that you can, a public health professional, whether you're in academia or you're in a health department, can make those bridges is just relating to people on common ground. And I think most people understand the need for public health and they understand the importance of public health, you know, and you may have a whole variety of different, you know, political spectrum of how much they want to fund public health. But, you know, most people, regardless of their political affiliations, I don't have to convince that safe food is an important thing.
Yeah.
Right. So that everybody, you know, there's other things that might be more controversial. But I think if you, there's two ways to get to people. One is appealing to their kind of their sense of their own general health and how that might apply to public health. So if you say, well, do you want to have, you know, food with salmonella on it? No. Do you want to feed that to your kids? No. And so I think that's one way. But the other way really is through data. And I think that that's really important. And because I think we in public health, again, we have a trust with the public already. Generally, we have a trust with politicians because we're generally seen as relatively neutral. And if we can show the data, we can collect the data and show the data in a way that can convince an argument. So I was just at the at CSTE, which is the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiology, their annual meeting. And I'm looking at Sana's water bottle, and she has supporting local needle exchange. And one of the things I thought, there was a speaker there, right, which is controversial, right, in a lot of settings. But so there was a speaker there from Kentucky, and he was, you know, not a typical, what you would think, you know, he's certainly not a liberal public health kind of, you know, he was a former police officer, and he was basically put in charge by the governor to kind of deal with the opioid crisis. And so you would have thought, being former law enforcement, that his response would have been mostly, you know, more of the on that side of things, more laws, more regulations, more kinds of things. And what he said to, you know, but he's speaking to a group of epidemiologists, and he said, what I want to thank you for is the fact that you provided data to us so that we could actually implement policy changes. And he said, if you would have told me when I was a young cop that I would have been supportive of needle exchange, I would have told you you were crazy. He's like, but because of the data that you guys have shown us, we know that people are more likely to go into rehab if they have, if they work with needle exchange. And EMS and other public service, public safety agencies or, so cops, EMS, firefighters, their chances of having an accidental needle stick go down like 60% if they're in an area where you have needle exchange, which makes perfect sense. But they needed the data in order, you know, it took them almost, I think, 2 or 3 legislative sessions before they were finally able to introduce that. And so I think that that's the other thing that's really important. Again, whether you're in research at an institution or you're at a health department, being mm-hmm. able to ask the question in a way where you can collect good data, design, you know, an intervention or a study that you can actually track information and do those things, I think mm-hmm. that is how we can actually implement policy change. Because, you know, it's one thing to say, well, we think needle exchange is a good idea. It's another thing to say, here's the data, here's what it shows, and that there's benefits outside of, you know, this narrow group of people who might yeah. need it. There's yeah. benefits beyond that into the society as a whole and to people you wouldn't even expect, like, you know, EMS and yeah, fire and other things.
External
right.
sticks and law right. enforcement and everybody, yeah.
Right.
And just, yes, like you said, our community as a whole, like our rates mm-hmm. of infectious diseases right. that are out
right.
there.
Right. So I think those, I think that's really where yeah. it's important for public health to mm-hmm. really remember the power that we have, and it's how we can yeah. kind of inform both the community and politicians to make more and better informed choices.
So I think the last thing that we didn't touch on with SAFER was, and I don't know too much, but I think it was from that seminar you went to about the chronic disease in IBS.
Oh, you talked about it in my class, about
yeah. new research yeah. on that.
So that's what we just submitted the R01 on. And so one of the things, so my research area is in foodborne diseases, and that really stemmed from SAFER because I really wanted to do outbreak investigations when I was working, when I was kind of developing SAFER, and also when I did start my dissertation for my PhD, you know, I wanted to do outbreaks, but again, they're hard to track and they're hard to time and, you know, mm-hmm. everything. So so I really focused on foodborne because those are the most common types of outbreaks that we have. And so for many, many years, I focused on some of the acute outcomes associated with foodborne diseases and the risk factors associated with getting a foodborne disease. But as we started talking to, you know, we've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews with SAFER now. And every once in a while, you would get somebody who maybe it was outside that, you know, you actually ended up interviewing them much later for whatever reason. They got reported later. And we started talking to people. It seemed like they were having symptoms a lot longer than kind of you would typically think of. Mm-hmm. And so I started looking into this originally and found that there's been some research associated with these enteric infections and these kind of chronic long-term outcomes. And so they're called post-infectious sequelae. And it can be everything from, so IBS, so like irritable bowel syndrome, to reactive arthritis and joint symptoms. But they're really challenging to study because of multiple reasons. One, there's not an easy like blood test you can do to test for it. Two, IBS is pretty common, but not mm-hmm. all IBS is caused by infections, but some of it is. Things don't always match up. So if you have a diarrheal infection and then a few weeks later your joints start to hurt, you might not necessarily think that those two are related. And so we've been doing more and more kind of research into this and found that, you know, there really is a lot more epidemiological evidence linking these things together. And the reason why that's important is it's not just, okay, that's interesting. It's when you start to think about public health resources and other things. So foodborne disease, we know foodborne diseases affect, you know, 1 in 6 Americans every year and have a certain economic impact just on the acute outcomes. But you can imagine that if you're somebody who gets sick and you're sick for a few days and then you recover, your economic burden is going to be very different than somebody who gets sick, develops IBS, mm-hmm. and has IBS for weeks, months, years after that. And some people, these are lifelong afflictions. And so then it becomes much bigger burden. And it's like, okay, how can we see if we can actually, you know, kind of modify that or find a way to keep that from happening? So we're doing more, creating a cohort of patients who have had those infections and then following them over time so that we can get an idea of what kinds of infections they're having or what kinds of outcomes they're having. There also have been very, very, very few studies, in fact, none that I can think of, in like ethnically diverse populations. So yeah. Most of them have done in like Northern European countries. So they're pretty much all white. Mm-hmm. And we know that ethnicity can be a risk factor for getting the disease, but nobody knows if ethnicity is a risk factor for getting these outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so we want to follow people. But in addition to that, what's unique to our study, we hope, if it gets funded, is that we're also getting the sample from the person when they got sick. And we're going to test the pathogen that made them sick and see if the pathogen also has a role. So we know that there's risk factors with it for people, you know, whether or not they their age, and women are slightly more likely to get like IBS. If they had anxiety and depression, that's a risk factor. How much weight they lost when they were sick was a risk factor. But we have know almost nothing about the pathogen. And so we're trying to see if there are specific like virulence genes or adhesion factors or other kinds of things within the pathogen that also make it more likely. And then eventually seeing if we can kind of put all that information together and eventually identify the people who are at highest risk and then see if we can do something to kind of keep them from developing IBS.
Wow. So, that is so cool.
So that's kind of
innovative. Yeah, that's very innovative.
That's where that area of research is going. And I think that, but it's, you know, it gets back to how challenging it is to study, because you can't, you know, I can't go back and like interview IBS patients and say, so in the last six months, did you have a GI illness? Did you have like diarrhea for a few days? Like, first of all, you know, the recall bias would be ridiculous. And then even if somebody actually had a documented case, we don't necessarily know because we haven't followed them prospectively. And so we really have to be able to do those prospective studies so that we can see, okay, you didn't have IBS when you first got your salmonella infection. Yeah. So now we're going to see if 6 months after if you develop IBS. Yeah. There's a really interesting book, and I'm not going to remember the name of it at the moment.
That's one of the questions.
I know, and if I would have known, I would have written it down. But that looks at the infectious cause of chronic diseases. And I think that there are so many more. I mean, so we know, you know, we know HPV in cancer, and we know, you know, H. pylori in stomach cancer. But there's just not that many good studies. And part of it is because of the way, you know, even in health departments, right? So you have infectious disease is usually its own division, and chronic disease is is another division, and nary the two will meet often. And so I think when you put together that infectious disease and chronic disease, it is challenging to kind of get reviewers who understand both, and you get people who understand, and also just to make those causal connections. So it is challenging.
Really build a collaborative team with experts in each different category and then have them all talking to each other, including public health departments and the college itself and academia and research.
And so like for that grant I just described, you know, we have collaborations with the Maricopa County Department of Public Health, with the Colorado State Health Department, so that we can actually get those cases, because that's really the only way we're going to get cases in a timely manner is to work with the health departments, because we need their surveillance systems.
That's awesome. Can you just go ahead and explain what One Health is?
Sure. So One Health is really this idea that we're looking at where disease happens at the intersection between human, animal, and environmental health. So you can have kind of a narrow view of One Health. So if you think about zoonotic diseases, so something like West Nile virus. So West Nile is circulating in bird populations, and then you have mosquitoes that end up biting horses, which get sick, and you have mosquitoes that bite people, which get sick. And then, of course, the environment plays a role, because you need the right environment for the birds to survive and the mosquitoes to thrive and enough water. And so all of those things come together to kind of create this disease system that has all of these three areas impacted. And so, that's one where, I mean, One Health kind of grew out of zoonotic disease. It was really started as a response to avian influenza, because avian influenza is still pretty scary disease.
Oh, yeah.
And it's something that's happening and is tracked globally. But I think what large agencies like WHO and CDC and World Bank all realize is that you had people working in very kind of siloed areas. And so for avian influenza, for instance, you would have people doing surveillance on chickens, but and then you would also have wildlife biologists that were doing surveillance in migratory birds, but they were never talking to each other. They never had any idea that, oh, look, the migratory birds are actually sharing a common space with the chickens when they land in these areas. And then, you know, what does it look like when they go in highly, you know, densely populated areas with people? And so we really wanted to be able to bring all of those together. And I think since that time, One Health has really expanded on how do we bring all of these kind of they're not divergent, right? We have human health, mm-hmm. animal health, and environmental health. And I think once you take a step back and you look, you realize like how interconnected they all are. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes the research has been very siloed. And you may have one person who maybe works in one or two areas and another that works in another area. But what it really means is that you have to have multidisciplinary research and you have to bring multiple people together because you're not ever going to have an expert in all of those areas. You may have somebody who gets the big picture, who can see all of those areas that come together, but they still need to reach out to, I need to go talk to somebody who's a climate scientist. I need to go talk to somebody who is a veterinarian. I need to talk to a human, you know, an MD. I need to go talk to an epidemiologist. And so it's really about kind of creating these team science ideas. Mm-hmm. And One Health is really important when we address a lot of these big kind of grand challenges. You know, wicked problems are really something that is not going to be solved by a yes or no answer, is not going to be solved by one person or one agency or one group or even
one country.
Right. Yeah. And so one of the ways that we're trying to address these things is to kind of work under a One Health model. And it's really more of a model than a discipline in and of itself. Yeah. I think, you know, your discipline might be infectious disease, or it might be human-animal interaction, right? So it could be that, Sana mentioned our partnership with the PEAM Animal Care Center.
Mm-hmm. It was the cutest partnership because it involved newborn kittens.
Right. So it helps that when you take your class out and you get to, you know, they
cuddle,
listen to their lecture with kittens on their laps. So it helps. but one of the things, so for instance, PAC is really trying to take a much more One Health approach to their services and say, okay, why are people dropping off their dogs? And is it because there's something wrong with their environment, i.e. they don't have fencing in their house?
Yeah.
Well, can we just find a way to get them fencing?
Yeah, put a $20 fence up.
Right.
And that's the thing about One Health is that you can apply that perspective to a lot of different problems, and you would never know that that problem should be looked at from a One Health perspective. So.
Yeah, and it's really trying to do it from like a solutions-oriented rather than, you know, so what are things that we could do? And so for PAC, we really want to, we have this relationship with them because they're much more of a holistic organization, and they recognize the fact that when animals are in trouble, it's often because their human is in trouble.
Yeah.
And their human is in trouble is often a public health, falls within the realm of public health, right?
Yeah.
And so whether it's mental health or whether it's need for food or homelessness or other kinds of things. And so so I think that having that partnership and that approach is pretty important. And so I think that that's really the direction where a lot of, you know, not that One Health is going to take over public health, but I think it's definitely being recognized as we need to stop. You know, we've been saying for years, we can't work in silos, but then everybody goes back to their silos.
Yeah.
But for One Health, like, due to its inherent nature, you literally can't work in your silos.
Yeah.
And it's been, so it's forcing that multidisciplinary work.
And I was curious because I think so much of why public health is in silos is because of funding sources.
Absolutely.
And so I'm curious how One Health, so has that helped kind of shake up that funding structure to say, we have this larger issue that we need to address?
So, yes and no. So I will say that One Health funding is interesting, right? So on smaller scales, so like if you go and look in grants.gov and you put in One Health, mostly what you're going to find is zoonotic diseases still. And so and it's like, well, you know, you have to, there's zoonotic diseases. You could just have a, you know, a zoonotic epi working on it, right? But on the big scale, One Health is starting to get funded on very, very large scale. Like, for instance, USAID will give, you know, gives grants on the order of $80 to $100 million to do these One Health projects. Mostly in developing countries, and so not most of the money goes to the developing country, not to entities within the U.S. But you have to work in this One Health model. You have to bring in all of these groups. And part of so it's a challenge, right? If I, as a researcher, want to do a project and I need to fund myself as a researcher, I need a certain amount of money to fund myself and my team. But if my team now becomes, you know, five PIs plus all of their people, because we have to do this multidisciplinary approach, it is challenging because in order to fund those types of projects and fund research in those areas, it's hard to make sure that 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 everybody's funded in a way that they can actually contribute to the research in a meaningful way and they're not just on there. There was a really good article that came out. It was in the One Health Journal. I have students read it. And part of it is kind of an assessment of papers and studies that claim to be One Health. And how you can, as a reader, how you can assess that and say, okay, well, if they just mention, oh, yeah, and it, we did it here, and the environment was this. Like, no, that's not enough to say, like, there has to be actually an assessment of the environment and how does it have an impact. And so even studies that claim to be One Health often aren't or just very and it's okay. I think we're working towards that. It could even just be a matter of you saying, you know, we got three quarters of the way there, and in order to get the rest of the way, we would really want to have this data or this partnership or whatever the case may be. And part of it is just first just recognizing where we need additional data. And I think the other challenge with One Health is data because so I know what health department data looks like. I will tell you, I'm not sure that health department data is going to interact very well with NOAA data, which is going to interact with, you know, data that Climis, you know, Climis is collecting on different types of environmental data or what kind of veterinary data is being collected and how that can get merged in. So that also becomes the biggest challenge with One Health. And one of the things we're trying to get students in the One Health program to think about is how you know, with that systems thinking, part of that systems thinking is you have to think about the data and how that data can be utilized together.
So in your opinion, what are some of the major wicked problems, public health problems that should be reframed from a One Health perspective? And how can that be done, you know, from public from a public health department standpoint?
So I think antimicrobial resistance is a big one, right? I mean, I think there's nothing scarier in human medicine and animal medicine, for that matter, and public health in general, then the idea of going back to a pre-antibiotic world, right? That it will change medicine as we know it. So I think that so antibiotic resistance or antimicrobial resistance is something that is huge, and I think partly because we have, you know, we have antibiotics used in human medicine, we have antibiotics used in veterinary medicine, we have antibiotics used in food production, and then there's antibiotics who that get into the environment and how they get transferred, you know, in our water and other kinds of things. So it really becomes this huge issue. And just telling, you know, and you can see how just telling a pediatrician to not give antibiotics when a kid has an ear infection is not going to change that big picture, right? Yeah. They're going to change a little piece of it, hopefully. But from that big, broad, challenging problem, you're not really going to have a huge impact. And so we have to attack it from multiple angles. So antibiotic resistance is one. Some of the other things that...
Climate change.
Yeah, climate change is another, right? And I think, you know, so this year I'm actually flipping our class so that climate change is first. Okay. Because I feel like climate change has such an impact on everything, yeah, right? It has an impact on everything from food safety to emergencies to how urban planning. I mean, it just on and on and on and on. And so I think thinking about climate change in that One Health perspective, one, how can we adapt to climate change because we've gotten past the point of being able to mitigate it, right? Mm-hmm. So how we use a One Health model to adapt to climate change, and then how we can use a One Health model to try and do some mitigation so that the adaption doesn't have to be so extreme. We lucked out last year in that there happened to be national disaster planning exercise that was going on at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to participate in that that conference that they had. Mm-hmm. And then later on, we had some students who worked on some of the problems that would come up related to environmental disasters from a One Health perspective. And they ranged everything from, you know, what do you do with pets that are shelters, right? So we know that people bring their pets to shelters. Well, you know, they're starting to have shelters who will take pets, but they, you know, they can't take all of them. And how do you deal with that? And so thinking about pets. And so we had one student that proposed after the event happened, using veterinary clinics as sentinel locations to be able to do exposure assessments. So you know that if, you know, in this particular case, it was like a chemical spill was the example.
Train derailment
with chemical spill. Well, if your, you know, dog who weighs, you know, a quarter or less of what you do is starting to have symptoms, there's a good chance that you're also exposed. They're also closer to the ground, right? So there's all kinds of ways that you can think about, you know, one, your care about the health of your animals, especially your pets, but then also how can we utilize and bring in the veterinarians because they also care about the health of the animals so that they're feeling like they're taking part in that surveillance as well. Yeah. And so a lot of it is just kind of coming up with a list of like unusual partners and who are, you know, if we were to take this from a One Health approach, who do we need at the table? And I think sometimes people, you'd be surprised, I have been, how willing people are to come to the table because they, you know, it's kind of like, well, thank you. I didn't even think about that. Or, you know, like in this instance, it's like, well, maybe we need fish and game there because there's a wash that runs right through. You wouldn't necessarily think we need fish and game after, you know, explosion that happened in a train yard in the middle of town. But it's like, well, there's a wash that's right there and there's a lot of wildlife that's in that area and we need to think about them too. So,
And when you have different people at the table, it's crazy to see what's so obvious to them that everybody else could have missed because that's what they've been studying and that's what's their expertise. So it is so important to have different stakeholders at the table.
I think about in my advocacy class, my instructor, Maya, said jokingly, and I was kind of in a place of being like, what am I going to do with this degree? And she was like, well, as you can see, public health is everything. And I was like, great, really narrowing it down. But, you know, that's really helping me when I'm trying to figure out what to do professionally. But I'm curious, how do we get other folks to see what they do is having a tie to public health? You know, like students who are studying other degree that doesn't seem to have a very direct connection to public health. But then, so how do we kind of also prep people outside of public health to see their role in it?
I think that's the challenge, right? That's and that's the things that health departments struggle with all the time. But I think, you know, a lot of that is, you know, one of the ways that I helped kind of build the One Health Consortium here, you know, I had a lot of coffee dates with people, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was just like explaining to people like what public health was, what we do, because I think a lot of people think public health and they think restaurant inspections yes. and they think school vaccines, yeah. right? Yes. Like they don't think about the bigger picture.
Dirty dining.
Yeah. Yes, and so, exactly. And that's fine. That is part of what we do, but it's not all of what we do. And certainly not from a research perspective. Mm-hmm. And so I think just reminding people that exactly what Maya said, like public health is everything.
Yeah.
And so what you just have to do is figure out what part of everything appeals to them mm-hmm. and then appeal to that. And mm-hmm. so that's probably the biggest challenge. But, you know, ultimately, most of these collaborations come down to having conversations with people, reaching out to people and doing kind of that legwork to do that. Because, mm-hmm. you know, we can do a lot of, you know, mass media types of campaigns, you know, on the huge budgets the public health has, which is not true.
Yeah.
But I think that ultimately it's just, you know, being an advocate for public health and reminding people of all of the different things. You know, mm-hmm. I think it was a few years ago, I don't know if you guys have saw them, that there were these stickers that APHA put out that just said, this is public mm-hmm. health.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, at our college, of course, we saw them everywhere. But I think that, you know, putting those stickers everywhere and putting them outside of, you know, reminding people, you know, like your bathroom, this is public health. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a no smoking sign, this is public health, right? Like, there's a reason yeah. that you don't walk into a building and get hit with a bunch of secondhand yeah. smoke anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's because of public health. Mm-hmm. And so I think just reminding people that the fact that, you know, we don't have as many people die in car crashes that we yeah. used to have because mm-hmm. we have, you know, seatbelts, because we collected data on why it was important for people to wear seatbelts, right? Mm-hmm. That is all public health. And so reminding people of that, I think, is a diligent thing that we have to all do, but yeah. something that's important.
Yeah, need more stickers.
We do. Yeah, yeah. More stickers.
People love
obviously
stickers.
Not enough. Yeah. They're all public health themed. Just to piggyback off that question, what do you do when you find yourself to be in too much of an echo chamber? And how do you kind of, because public health can be very much of an echo chamber sometimes, so how do you change your communication if you're talking to somebody who doesn't have the same beliefs as you?
Well, I think
somebody that believes in,
again, a lot of it is just finding whatever small common ground you can and then relating to people that way. So, you know, like I have family members that are, you know, a little bit farther on the right than I would love. Mm-hmm. And so part of it is just appealing to the things that they, you know, and it's like, okay, well, we can't agree on these things, but what about these things? And do you mm-hmm. see, you know, like, and I mean, I've also been known to send yes. people emails with like well-cited sources because again, it gets back to data, which is like, okay, maybe the resources you're looking at, aka Fox News, mm-hmm. don't talk about these things. But here's another side of it, and here's all the resources. And if you click here and here and here and here and here and here and here, you will see another side of the story. So mm-hmm. I think a combination of one, being facts driven and not being as emotionally driven
yes.
Is extremely important, because it's one thing for people to say, well, you're just getting upset about it because, you know, you yeah. have this particular worldview. And you're like, no, I'm getting upset about it because I have thousands of research studies that are well done mm-hmm. That I can point to, and that, you know, this consensus of science. And mm-hmm. I think that's my biggest like pet peeve right now is yeah. this idea that, you know, that science is somehow being belittled or somehow being yeah. minimized because of the politics going on. And it's like, you know, yeah. we've always been a country of science mm-hmm. and innovation. And if we lose that, we're in a lot of trouble. I don't care mm-hmm. what end of the aisle you're on. And so trying to get people back to that idea of like, okay, maybe you don't want to listen to one person, but what if 100 people say it? What if 200 people say it? And, you know, I get, the vaccine debate, which is not a debate.
Well, Dr. Pagruba Brown is known for doing a lot of outreach on Facebook. A lot of Facebook, we'll call it outreach.
Outreach is
commenting.
One.
Yeah, that's how I'm going to put it.
Facebook education.
Yes. So, it's challenging because I just don't, from an inherent standpoint, I don't understand. You wouldn't build a bridge without an engineer.
Yeah.
And if you're, and I also, if you went to your doctor because you had a weird lump in your neck, you would want them to talk to you about cancer or being able to do all the latest tests. But for some reason, certain things, they just all of a sudden, it's like, oh no, the doctor doesn't know anything. Or, oh no, these thousands of scientists don't know anything. And it's also this, where they have to have, we have to show both sides. No, you don't, right? Because there is no other side. Or if you're going to show both sides, here, you can have the one anti-vaccine, whatever, not actual.
Don't name him.
I won't. Person on one side. Well, then here, why don't you have 10,000 pediatricians on the other side.
Yeah.
Because that's the balance. Mm-hmm. And when you show it one-to-one, it looks like it's an equal argument. And it is absolutely not an equal argument. The same thing is true about climate change, right? So you can have one anti-climate change person. Well, then have the 10,000 scientists on the other side who've written countless articles showing it and have data from thousands of different sources. Mm-hmm. Put those people together. And so I think that is where I hope that we can start to make a shift in the politics in this country, is that they start to see that science is important and science, can be apolitical. And we struggle with that as epis. Like, we talk about that as, at what point do you go from being, apolitical to being, an advocate for something? And we do have to be very careful that we don't, that we advocate on our own time, kind of thing, because you don't ever want your science to be called into question because you may have a certain, political affiliation or whatever.
Yeah.
And because the science is ultimately what's most important and the data is ultimately what's most important. And so we want to make sure that we're always keeping it. Even if you have your own personal opinions, you have to keep it out of that when you're doing your data collection and your analysis and all those things, because, all it takes is one person to screw up their data or fudge data, and it literally screw up everybody's science for years to come.
Yeah. Well, and it makes me think about earlier how you were talking about how people in general trust public health and trust health departments. And so is it a matter that those are the individuals who should be having conversations about these kind of larger issues? Or how can these other professions look to public health as an example of saying, this profession has built trust with communities?
And it's hard because a lot of, all public health agencies are government agencies, so they're very limited by what we should say. So I thought that after the latest measles outbreak, I thought that CDC should just come out with a PR campaign that just said, told you so. Right? Because it absolutely, there are very few things in this world we can predict. But it turns out that we can predict, as vaccine rates go down, infections go up, and it's so predictable.
Yes.
And but CDC can't do that. They can't have a campaign that says "Told you so," which would be amazing.
In so many words. But
so
that would be
right.
Cool.
So I think it is. It's challenging because a lot of people's hands are tied based on their government affiliation, and so a lot of it is just talking to people in your day to day life about how important these things are. Mm-hmm. Everybody who knows me knows my feelings about vaccines and my well-cited beliefs about vaccines.
Your evidence-based beliefs.
Right. They're not beliefs because I feel it. Yeah. They're beliefs because there is a preponderance of evidence showing it. So,
word of the day, preponderance.
Yeah. Yes. So I think that That's important. And I think, you know, like I said, I think, again, like I mentioned before about that former police officer who's working in Kentucky, I think it gets back to the data. And if you can just show people the data, and if you can show it to them without coloring it in any way and just be like, here's the data, you know, and here's what we did, and answer their questions honestly about what they have, and be able to interpret and also be able to explain the data. I think science communication is something that's extremely important. And I think we've been our own worst enemy at that in science, because we have we don't want to dumb down the science, which is true. But at the same time, if people can't understand what you're doing, then they go to resource or sources of information that are bogus. And that becomes the overwhelming kind of noise in the room. And so we need to get better about communicating that information in a way that's thoughtful. And it's hard. Like, I don't tweet. Like, that's not something I want to deal with. Mostly I just don't have time. But there needs to be multiple forms of communication, and we need to be able to embrace the fact that people need information in a variety of ways.
And where they get it from.
And where they get it from is important. I had an undergrad student one time ask me, he's like, well, why do you even care about this stuff? And I was like, I didn't really know how to answer him. And I was like, why? And he was like, why don't you? You know, you know, and I think his thought was that, okay, well, only, you know, a couple thousand people a year die from foodborne diseases, but it's like, it's a bigger impact than just death, you know? Yeah. And also feeling like you have confidence in the food that you're eating is also important. Like, I don't want to be terrified every time I eat something. Yeah. So it's, I do think that that's important. I'm trying to think of like the list of foods, like you really shouldn't eat cookie dough. I know. Sad. That's what everybody is like. Public health ruins everything. And I'm like, well, you know, you can.
Just know your risk.
You know, and it's like, And the thing is like, people are like, oh, well, we didn't have eggs in the cookie dough. And you're like, was your flour pre-baked? Because the last outbreak was associated with the flour. And so, you know, and like I said, I can be a little bit hypocritical on that point sometimes, but as a general food safety rule, you shouldn't eat raw cookie dough either. So even though, again, it's good. But
I could talk to you all day.
This is great.
But I know you need to get back to doing one of the hundreds of projects that you're working on that you discussed with us today. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
I knew we could talk about all of this for a while. So thank you so much.
If you are looking to obtain continuing education credits for listening to this podcast, please head to moodle.publichealth.arizona.edu and click on the Keeping Up with Public Health tab in the WR PHTC section and take the post-evaluation survey for this episode. This podcast is supported by the Western Region Public Health Training Center. You can find more of our work at www.wrphtc.arizona.edu. You can also find us on Twitter at WRPHTC. A special thank you to Eric Healy for editing and producing the show, in addition to creating the music for each episode.